This lecture, Yearning for the Ancient Ways, was given by Reverend Tejo Munich at Zen Center of Asheville on June 26, 2013.
I went to Japan with that thought, you know, what is Japanese culture that is not really, that's just extra?
Yeah.
And what is the real spirit of it? How can I sort this so that we don't lose something
yeah.
in the process of kind of tweaking it? And when somebody asks me to talk about American Zen, you know, I immediately go to this rather negative place, because it feels to me like what I'm hearing at teachers' meetings a lot is, we want to Americanize Zen. We don't want to, you know, we don't want the Japanese culture. And which I understand it on one level, because the Japanese culture has become as embedded or as stuck as Christianity has become in this country, so that it's very definable. It's created a definable way of practicing spirituality, which, you know, if you think about life as constantly changing, how can it be definable? Which is, you know, what I'm always talking about. And so the ways in which we even practice the precepts, for example, it can't be, you know, this is the way you do it and this is the way you don't do it, because it really depends on how things are in any particular moment. So it has become a big question for me, and I think I said this last time, that when Chimyo went to Japan, I said, I want you to consider what parts of this we can drop. Because, you know, people come to Great Tree and they try to impress upon me how it's so unfamiliar and it's so inaccessible in some ways. And yet, I haven't seen, except in maybe somebody like Thich Nhat Hanh or my own teacher, I haven't seen somebody who's been able to make it alive and still have that depth. And I went back to this Shobogenzo Zuimonki, which is a collection of Eijo, the student of Dogen, put together talks and things that it was pretty informal talks of Dogen. And I think what it was that, you know, I sort of, as I was reading it over, I was sort of picturing this, his students kind of talking to him about various things and him kind of just responding in these informal talks. And because I thought, well, what is it? I want to go back to this poem again about yearning for the ancient ways. What is it that Dogen was yearning for? What are the ancient ways? And not just Dogen, but Katagiri Roshi and myself. What does it mean to talk about yearning for the ancient ways? What are the ancient ways that we yearn for? I can feel it. I remember when I first heard this poem, when Katagiri Roshi first introduced this poem to us, thinking, I mean, not thinking, but responding with my whole body, yes. And that I feel that the practice that we did, particularly at the monastery at Hokyoji with Katagiri Roshi, was very kind of old style, you know? And we loved it. We all loved it. What was it that we all loved so much? And also in the monastery in Japan, in Hoshinji, there was something, I mean, it was almost like, you know, it sort of reminded me of how I was drawn to the hippie movement when I was in the monastery in Japan, because it was very traditional food, very traditional ways of doing things. We heated the bath with wood-burning stoves. We had, I can't think of what they're called, those big pots that you that are filled with ashes, and you have charcoal. That was our main source of heating our room. Hibachi, yes, thank you. We each had hibachi in our room, and we were each allocated some coal. And they even made coal at Hoshinji at one time. They weren't making it when I was there, but and we made our own miso, and we grew our own food, and it was very basic. It was a very basic way of, a simple way of living. So when I read, he talks about a thatched hut, snowy evening, deep mountain. That's what it makes me think about. It makes me think of this very simple and basic life. So what is the relationship between, you know, the kinds of rituals and things that we have and the kinds of forms and the style of practice that we have and this simple way of living? I mean, it is a very simple practice, and when we do sesshins, you know, the rhythm is there. We just fall into these sesshins, no matter how far off the schedule we've gotten prior to that. Chimyo and I, we just fall into the sesshin schedule and love it, you know. So the question is, what is it? So the poem is, the way of the ancestors coming from the west I transmit to the east, yearning for the ancient ways, catching the moon, cultivating the clouds, untouched by worldly dust fluttering about. A thatched hut, snowy evening, deep mountain. And as I mentioned the last time, one of the things that stood out to me was this idea of untouched by worldly dust fluttering about. What this means to me is not being, not standing still in the practice, not, or in our lives, not being still long enough for dust to collect, so that it's an alive practice. It's not a kind of spiritual practice which is deadened by the by imposed ideas about what is the right way to behave, or what are people thinking of me. And Dogen talks about this over and over. I went back to Dogen because I thought, well, not only what is yearning for the ancient ways, but what are the similarities between what I experience, what we experience in our spiritual practice, and the conflicts that we have within our culture, and what are the things that we yearn for, so what is the sincere practice that we yearn for, and the simple living, or the simple way of being present that we yearn for, that is the same as what Dogen was looking for, and the same as what Shakyamuni Buddha was looking for. And I can't help but always, whenever I'm thinking about this, thinking about how my mother was always talking about how if we didn't practice our religion in our everyday life, that there was no point in going to church. You know, this was a really important thing to her. She didn't know a lot about Catholicism because her mother had really rejected it. So she wasn't raised in the same way I was. You know, I had all that. All that, you know, stuff, you know, that it's hard for me to sort out. When I read Thomas Merton, I remember his early books are so inspirational. You know, and I thought, wow, you know, he's within this institution, the same institution I was within. Why is he able, how is he able to pull out the essence like that? And I thought, oh, because he wasn't raised in it. He didn't have all that stuff that he had to shed. So when I got into Buddhism, you know, my idea was that, you know, I was new, and I could just get the essence. I didn't have a lot to shed. And to some extent, this is true. You know, but we still, as humans, have this inclination, no matter how we were raised, to want something to kind of grasp onto. And so you'll see on a lot of, you know, Zen centers across the United States, and maybe you even see it at Great Tree, I don't know, this kind of, this is the way it is, and people like that. And I know that a lot of people get frustrated with me because I'm constantly kind of changing my mind, but I feel like, you know, we have to kind of let things unfold in a certain way too. So again, you know, where does the tradition come in to allowing life to unfold? I wrote a few comments as I was thinking about this. I've been reading through the Zui Monkey, and there's lots of places where he talks about things that I think are very related to what I'm talking about, and which really get at the essence of what specifically Zen practice is about. And he keeps going back to Zazen. And one of the things that I kept thinking as I was reading through was how Ensh Kantaza was how Zazen sort of helps, it brings us back to the present moment. Shikantaza is really just sitting in the moment. And how when we come back to the present moment, it's not an intellectual process, but how when we are just here in the present moment, we are more likely to see the delusion of trying to adhere to a specific way of being. And how we might let go of some of these things which are not so useful, that are just kind of accumulated over the years, which is what we saw in Catholicism, one of the reasons why, you know, I was so willing to throw out the baby with bathwater, because we could see how much was collected, not just culture, because of cultural things, but because of needs of a specific time, which I guess you could say are somewhat cultural, but
or male dominance.
Pardon?
Male dominance as well.
Well, and there was a certain amount of that too. But that again is cultural too. So, you know, to think about think about it in that way, we also have to consider how much of an overlay of our culture are we imposing on this practice, you know, by trying to bring it into the 21st century America. You know, and I think we have to be careful about that. And one of the things that Dogen talks about a lot is not, and he talks about it in a lot of different ways in the Zui Monkey, is how we have to be careful about how we make decisions about what we're going to do. And he was talking very much to monks, but for example, somebody must have brought up the question about someone. A lay person had asked them to write a letter on their behalf, and they were wondering whether this was something a monk should be doing. And he said, you have to look at why you're doing it or why you're not doing it. Because if you're not doing it because you think this is something a monk shouldn't be doing, and what would people think of them for entering into secular life in that way, then that's just your ego. But, you know, he says, you should write the letter, but write it without having anything attached to it, without having any judgments attached to it, basically, is what he's saying. And I think that this is something we need to look at. You know, I mean, this has been a real challenge for me since starting Great Tree, particularly, because there is the fact that, you know, it kind of goes in cycles, but a lot of the time, there's not a lot of people that come and practice at Great Tree. You know, the last session we had three people, and the time before we had two. It was just Shimyo and me, you know. So, you know, some of the response that I'm getting from some people is that, you know, because I need to present it in a more contemporary way. And this has been since the beginning that people have been telling me that. And I've tried to find ways to do that, and somehow it just, there's something in me that feels really artificial or superficial about doing things in that way. So while I think that the essence of this practice has a lot to offer to 21st century America, I don't know if the way to go about it is by buying into the way that it's usually done and the ways that are more familiar and more kind of user-friendly, you know. For example, one of the things I've had a lot of difficulty with is the idea of teaching online. I just think that there's so much potential for misunderstanding, and I've seen it in my attempts to do that. And even taping lectures, you know, when I got this thing from this person that's putting the book together, she said, well, you undoubtedly have a lot of lectures available that you can just choose one and edit it. And I went back and I said, well, no, actually I'm going to have to write this because, you know, from the very beginning I had an objection to taping lectures, and part of it had to do with all of the brouhaha around taping Katagiri Roshi's lectures. It was always such a huge deal, and then what are we going to do with them, and then making copies, and then the copies didn't work, and then all this stuff. And the other thing was a comment that Katagiri Roshi made one time, which was, if I thought that listening to a tape was a way to listen to the Dharma, he said, I would just tape my lectures ahead of time and leave them on the cushion. He didn't like sitting up there and giving lectures. And I really heard what he said, you know, and now as I go back and listen to some of his lectures, I think it's only because I was there that I even get anything out of them at all. Because you can find little bits and pieces, but in general, he was just all over the place, and half the time, I don't even know what he's talking about, even when I listen to them now, which is, I guess, we're being taped. But, you know, there's this question that I'm now pursuing via Dogen. What is it that he's talking about? And, you know, it goes back to the essence of what Dogen's teaching is all about, which is, what happens when we sit on the cushion? What is the actual experience of sitting on the cushion? And when we can in some way identify that, either through our own noticing or through reading something maybe that Dogen or some other practitioner has written about the experience and saying, oh, you know, without being able to understand it intellectually, but knowing it, knowing that experience. That when we are able to identify what this experience is that we have when we sit on the cushion, that we can see how it's working in our everyday lives. Even because it's a very subtle experience. It's a very, being present is, you know, like I always quote the Bendawa, how he talks about, you know, flowers and the trees and the grasses and everything begins to expound the Dharma, but it's not something that we can see with our conscious mind. So we can't see it when it's happening. We can't say, oh, I'm in the present moment now. Because as soon as we've said it, you know, we're not. Do you know? So this experience is a little bit elusive in one sense. But on the other hand, it's like yearning for the ancient ways. It's elusive only when we try to grasp what it is. Do you know? And so what Dogen talks about in the Shobo Genzo, and why I you know, want to go back at Shobo Genzo Zui Monkey and look at what he's saying, is I really want to try and find ways to point at what is the thread that has carried through since the time of Shakyamuni Buddha and before that even. I thought about one of the things that has struck me about Dogen Zenji, as in our study group, we're reading his life again. I mean, I'm reading it again. It's in the appendix. Is how his life, how when he lived, he was the society of the time was very much, I think, like contemporary America, in the sense that it had a very materialistic quality about it, and not just, you know, I mean, he grew up in the empirical court, but not just there, but in this, when he went to the monastery too, the whole emphasis was on, you know, study and very kind of informed, and he couldn't get his question answered. He was yearning for something that he couldn't find. And he studied both in Tendai monasteries, which was the most popular kind of monastery at that time, and also in Rinzai practice, which had just been introduced to Japan. And in both situations, he felt that it wasn't really getting at the heart of what it was that he was seeking. And I feel that this is very much the way our culture is now. You know, just what I was talking about before, about trying to make things accessible and trying to make things interesting and familiar and inspiring. What it does is it doesn't allow us to have that deeper experience of recognizing the reality of life, which is everything is always changing. So if we're always seeking after the familiar and always wanting something that's comfortable or that fits in with our way of understanding things, we can never awaken to the ever-changing nature of life and the discomfort that comes with first experiencing that ever-changing nature. It's not that we don't live within impermanence, but we don't like that feeling of having the rug pulled out from under us, which is what happens in every moment. We don't like that feeling. It's uncomfortable. And in a sense, what this practice does, in my experience, is it helps us to become comfortable with the uncomfortable. So that when we feel that unfamiliarity of we don't know what's coming next, we let it unfold rather than trying to define it or trying to understand it within the context of what we already think we know and giving it some solidity. I did want to share this one section because I thought this was a particularly good chapter in terms of addressing this question. He says, nowadays almost all people, both lay and clerical, want to make it known to others when they do something good and prevent others from noticing when they do something bad. Because of this, they lose correspondence between their inner and outer selves. I thought that was interesting. This is Shohaku's translation. They lose correspondence between their inner and outer selves. I thought that was a really good way of expressing how when we become too occupied with what we call the status quo, or how things appear, or how we appear, that we lose that connection. We are just working on the out, are just working within the outer world. You should aspire carefully to make this inside, the inside, correspond with the outside. Repent of faults and hide your real virtue. Do not adorn your outward appearance. Offer good things to others and accept bad things yourself. So then someone asked, surely we should maintain an attitude of hiding our true virtue and not adorning our appearance. And yet, for Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, it is essential to have great compassion and benefit living beings. If ignorant monks or lay people find faults, they will become guilty of slandering the priesthood. Even if they do not understand true inner virtue, if they see monks of good appearance, respect them, and make offerings to them, there must be some merit which brings about happiness. How should we think about this? And honestly, this is a lot of the spirit of Japanese Buddhism, is this kind of, monks should appear in this way. Otherwise, I even heard, this was even said to us by one of the monks. And I'm not saying everybody at the monastery was like this, but this particular monk was. He said, you shouldn't do this because the lay people will become disheartened or something like that, So there is that, there is that tendency, particularly among monks. And one of the things that Dogen emphasizes in his teachings is the equality between lay and monks' practice. And this comes up again and again, the precepts, it's the same precepts that are taken by monks and lay practitioners. It's the same practice. And Katagiri Roshi was very, partly because he was in the United States and he didn't have any choice because he didn't have any ordained monks when he first moved to Minnesota. But I didn't see him making those kinds of distinctions, even though it's very much done in Japan. He was a very Dogen person, and everyone was equal. We all did the same practice, and we didn't even think anything of it, There wasn't a hierarchical thing, except that you would have a certain position that would put you, it would make you responsible for more things. And I think this is a very important, it's been a source of conflict for many hundreds of years in Buddhism, as that's why the Vimalakirti Sutra was written. The Vimalakirti Sutra is not, presumably, it's not really a true story, but it's about, and it's an early story, early in the development of Mahayana Buddhism. It's about a layman named Vimalakirti who had transcended the egotistical ways of the world, and yet he was living within the world and doing all the things, going to bars and going to brothels, and he was married and he had a good, nice place, nice home, and family, and everything. But he was teaching the monks, and the monks were embarrassed by the corrections they had received from him. So it was sort of a way of kind of offsetting this idea that ordained people are cut up, But it's very easy. They're struggling with this out at San Francisco Zen Center, because even though Katagiri Roshi was very involved in the development of San Francisco Zen Center with Suzuki Roshi, and if you practice out there, lay practitioners and priests all have the same functions, it's there's no distinction. Still, they find that people look to the priests for, counsel and things. And they're trying to sort of offset that by giving some, giving more credibility. And we can't talk to Japan about that because they're like, oh no, why would you want to do that? So it's become somewhat embedded in Japanese culture, but it's already starting to develop in this. And then there's, all these endless discussions on the American Zen Teachers Google group about what should we call ourselves, all these titles. And Shohaku won't even, He won't take any title because he says it doesn't make any sense. So obviously he's influenced me a bit too. So anyway, Dogen's response is to this: although you do not adorn your outward appearance, it is irrational to become self-indulgent. If you carry out bad deeds in front of lay people on the pretext of hiding your true virtue, this is certainly a terrible violation of the precepts. Although some merely wish to gain fame as people of Bodhi mind and not have their faults known by others, the heavenly beings, the guardian deities, and the three treasures are secretly watching them. You know, and I think about, you know, what does that mean? These unseen, he calls them unseen deities in another part. I'm always talking about subtle life forms, but I also think that what he's getting at here, and this is something that I think we all sort of know on some level, is that people can sense the truth of our behavior, whether we hide it or not. That somehow, if we're really making an effort, I mean, not that we can ever completely be perfect people, but if we're really making an effort to be honest and sincere and follow our aspirations very sincerely, those people that we're with can feel that. And if we're not, that also gets communicated and influences those around us. So our own sincerity in our practice does have an influence with people around us. And I think that's more about what he's getting at, is that this is unseen, but it's part of the interdependent reality in which we live. And so to awaken to that interdependence, as well as awakening to impermanence, it helps us. It helps us in the way that we live. And this is something also that Dogen emphasizes, is the awakening to impermanence and interdependence as the basis for precepts, as the basis for all of our actions. What is being admonished against here is an attitude which feels no shame before unseen beings and covets the esteem of worldly people. You should consider things only for the sake of the flourishing of the Dharma and the benefit of living beings all the time and in whatever situation. Speak after making careful consideration. Act after giving attentive thought. Do not act rashly. Ponder over what is reasonable in whatever situation you encounter. Our life changes moment by moment. It flows by swiftly, day by day. Everything is impermanent and changing rapidly. This is the reality before our eyes. You do not need to wait for the teaching of masters or sutras to see it. In every moment, do not expect tomorrow will come. Think only of this day and this moment. Since the future is very much uncertain and you cannot foresee what will happen, you should resolve to follow the Buddha way, if only for today, while you are alive. To follow the Buddha way is to give up your bodily life and act so as to enable the Dharma to flourish and to bring benefit to all living beings. Again, you know, as I read this and as I was reading this, what struck me about how he talks about don't act rashly, ponder, think about it before you act, think about it before you speak, all of this has become part of my awareness through Zazen, through sitting, you know. And it's not, As soon as you notice, when you're watching your own movie, you sort of notice how things that you've done that during the day or in the past week or so, that interactions that you'd like to correct, you'd like to go back and correct, and you can't, and maybe you can offset it a little bit, but some things you can't go back and do over, most things. But what we can do is we can correct the way we approach things in the future. And like he says, don't act rashly. Consider what you do before you're doing it. And just the learning the ability to step back and not just react or respond is certainly something that we learn when we're sitting on the cushion. And when I was at Tassajara and Thich Nhat Hanh was teaching us, one of the things that he was questioning the forms of Buddhism and the rigidity of some of the forms. And for example, he was questioning whether you should hold your gassho up high, because we were taught to hold it up at eye level, and whether that's not kind of abusive, holding it down here is more compassionate towards yourself. One of the things that he questioned was whether we should sit for a particular period of time, like 40 minutes or 30 minutes. Or I think when I was at Palm Village, we sat for an hour. Yeah. Or whether we should just sit for as long as we want and then just get up. And that question has sort of lingered in my mind for a long time. And one of the values, I think, though, for me, of having a specific period of time is that during that time, there is this inclination to get up when something comes up that is challenging or is some kind of conflict, and to go through that and process through that. For example, if something comes up that we did that we're not comfortable about the outcome of or the way we did it, it makes it hard to sit when those kinds of things come up. But to be able to stay on the cushion and sit through that, we finish the process. And so I've come to the conclusion that it's not... of course, if something in your body is creating pain. I mean, there are times when I just lie down because I need to. And something like that, not to be abusive in the way that you're just so rigid with yourself. But at the same time, to recognize the value of the insights that come up as a result of staying with the process of something. And again, that's something that you can clearly see how that works in our everyday life. It's not something that... what was it? There was someone, I was thinking about this today, there's somebody that is struggling with something and wondering whether to continue with it. And I was realizing the value of this person continuing, following through and finishing the process. Finishing the process has been such a valuable lesson for me to learn in Zen practice. But also that ability to, and this is part of the process of stopping and wondering whether one should act or whether one should respond. And there's those times on the cushion when you get this great idea about how you should do something. And by the time the period is over, you realize it wasn't such a great idea after all. Or at least it's been diffused, so you don't plunge into it prematurely. So someone asked, according to Buddhist teaching, should we practice begging for food? And one of the things that took me into the Zui Monkey, is, and I didn't get far enough in it to find this particular section, but I remember reading in here one time how Dogen was saying to, how the monks were saying to Dogen, we understand the idea of begging works in India and it works in China, because the people there know what it means. But in Japan, nobody knows what it's about. And so, you know, we don't think we should do this here because it's just a strange thing. And I remember when I read that, because now, you know, in Japan, it's so embedded in the culture, you know. And of course, we feel the same way about bringing something like this to America. How do you bring it to America? And there are some people who have done it and have received some very positive feedback from it. But anyway, this question about begging came up, and I didn't remember this section, but this is what he says about it. And so Dogen says, you know, in this other part, he says that, you know, we need to introduce it into this country. This is a very good practice, both for monks and for lay people. And it is. I mean, having done it, I know it's an amazing connection. Lay practitioners are giving something for the Dharma, and monks are devoting their life to the Dharma in a certain way, you know, and chanting and giving teachings without necessarily expecting anything in return. So that's kind of the spirit of it. But what he says here is, he says, according to the Buddhist teaching, should we practice begging for food? Dogen says, yes, we should. Yes, yet we have to take into consideration the customs and conditions of each country. In whatever situation, we should choose what is best for the benefit of living beings in the long run and for the progress of our own practice. As for the manners of begging, since the roads in our country are dirty, if we walk around wearing Buddhist robes, they will become soiled. Also, since people are poor, it may be impossible to beg in the same way as in India, that is, at every house along the street with no regard for whether they are poor or rich. If we cling to such a way, our practice might regress, and we would be unable to function magnanimously for the benefit of living beings. Only if we keep practicing the Buddha way in a humble manner, following the customs of the country, will people of all classes support us by making offerings of their own accord, and will practice for themselves and for the benefit of others be fulfilled. What is best for the sake of the Buddha way and for the benefit of others should be considered in each situation. Forget personal profit and do not be concerned with your reputation. When I came back from Japan, I really wanted to live in the life of a monk, you know, and what does that mean in the United States in the 20th century? So I came back in 1988. And one of the most fortunate things that happened to me was that I got invited to Southern Dharma. And it was because Katagiri Roshi was sick that I got invited, because the Zen retreat was already scheduled, and so they needed somebody to fill in for him. But the practice of Dana was already happening at Southern Dharma. And I thought, oh, okay, this is a form of begging. And it's a nice practice because, and this is not something that I realized when I was in Japan, it enables people to give, to support the Dharma in whatever way they're able to. Even if it's just, you know, sometimes I would get like 10 yen, which is about 10 cents, you know. But you could feel the spirit of what they were doing. And what it does is it kind of, for me, it strengthened my resolve in this practice. It's hard. It's hard to live in that way. And it's hard to not know. And he addresses this here about, you know, how difficult it is to live. He addresses it in one of these sections, to live without knowing how, you know, where, what your next paycheck is going to be, how much is actually coming in, and things like that. It's very hard. And to, you know, find some way to live in that simple way without getting all caught up in doing things only for the sake of money, you know, only for the sake of getting something. Even weddings, somebody, you know, people ask me how much do you charge for a wedding? You know, to me, to perform a wedding ceremony is just a way of sharing the Dharma. So I always say, you know, I live on Dharma, and there is no particular charge. And I've done weddings where I've received nothing, you know. And you don't know, you never know. You know? But it's hard to explain the value of that kind of experience, you know. I guess anybody who's raised a family kind of knows that. It's gonna become kind of hand to mouth. But it's hard to sustain that kind of thing. You know, I mean, right now, I mean, I can say I'm living on Dharma, but I'm not living on Dharma. I've got a roof over my head. You know, a lot of things are taken care of for me. But there was a time when I was, and one of the things that struck me in here, in this one section that I just read, was he said, "You should practice the Buddha way wholeheartedly, if only for a day." And I thought, yeah, you know, if we wholeheartedly put ourselves into this practice, even just for one day, and have that experience, it gives us the inspiration to kind of keep working towards that intention. And because it takes us to a deep place, it helps us realize, you know, oh yes, this is what's really important. We know that, but it's easy to get caught up in, you know, life. So, okay, that's it. Well, does anybody want to say anything?
I guess the thing I wanted to say was that I cherish, I don't know what, the procedure.
Forms.
I do. Even at home, I know people who sit at home and, you know, don't bother with anything. I light a candle, I light incense, I wear my roksu, I do my vows, because it's all part of the thing with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm watching a documentary on Buddhism, and it's on Buddhism in Laos, Thailand, and Burma. And we've done the first two, you know, it's in Burma. And you know, I literally, it is so cool to see women and children in these temples. They walk, there's this temple in Rangoon that is the biggest thing on earth. And there's this level that's all marble. And it's like a football stadium with marble. And people are walking, families are walking, and all of a sudden a woman will, I don't know, decide to stop, plunk, and do some vows. And do some recitation and then the whole family has gone down and the whole family gets up. And you know, my heart is just warmed by that kind of, you know, I came from the same background you came from in many ways. I, you know, 18 years of Catholic education and just, you know, up to here with the duplicity, what I considered at the end, the duplicity. So I don't have a good feel for rules, rule makers, and a criticism. That's always been a tricky one. Criticism is tricky, you know. But anyways, I just have such a kind of a aww.
I guess, you know, there's something like if you grow up with ritual, as a child, I think children are so capable of discerning what is real and what is not. And when you grow up with ritual, you develop a true affinity for it because of the effect it has on had on you as a child.
Right.
You know, and so
to this day, when you're driving and an ambulance goes by, I do the sign of the cross. It's a connection with the person in that ambulance.
In the ambulance, yeah.
And, you know, I'm like, and I are important.
And whereas, you know, I can look at a lot of things in Catholicism, and I did. I systematically sorted through a lot of stuff when I was first started meditating. And I can look at a lot of things and just say, just throw it out. Now, but the ritual keeps coming back. And even, you know, I mean, it certainly did when I got into Zen. But then, even when I came back from Japan, it was like, oh, it's just meaningless. But then, as soon as people wanted it, and I started getting back into it. You know, it's like, no, this is not meaningless. There is something
cherished,
something important about ritual, and it doesn't matter what the ritual is.
Correct.
You know, I mean, we can make the rituals
for ritual's
more
sake, or is not.
It's just it has, and you know, and just follow the forms, and yeah.
It's part of it belonging to a community as well.
Yeah, that's the other thing.
It wraps you in.
Everyone moves together.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I'll be real honest, the reason I don't do sesshin is because Randall rolls his eyes, I've told him this. It's like, if I can't find a place that has a flat driveway, I'm not going. I have had coronaries going up your driveway and up Southern Dharma. I just can't do it. And I'm just like this big giant wolf.
Oh, well, don't let that hold you back. We'll come and get you.
I'm not doing it. I'm like not going. Every time I think, oh, yeah, I'll do this.
You don't like to physically ride up it, or you just don't want to drive up it?
Would you be in the passenger seat?
Eh?
Would you be in the passenger seat?
Well, I was a passenger once in Randall's car, and it wouldn't make it up halfway, and it was coming going back, and I thought,
well, you know, Chris owns the house next door now.
Yeah.
And so you don't have that.
We did, but it was like,
you don't have that steep part anymore. That's you can park next door now.
That's my thing.
I'm like, I'll get over it.
Well, I'm intrigued by the way that you started this was talking about people wanting you to contemporize. For some reason, to make it more palatable for them. And I'm not quite sure what they were thinking on that. I mean,
Orioki. No.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's what they meant.
No, it's not. It's not. They were talking about classes and things that were more accessible.
Okay. I mean, I think of Zazen, it's just a real fundamental experience. I mean, there's nothing to change there, but maybe.
It's sort of like
the dress,
weaving
forms.
In,
I mean, you know,
weaving in something that. Well, I like uniforms, you know, Catholic school girl. It's just so much easier.
Well, you're not the only one. I think people in general like
just don't make me think about what I have to put
forms.
On.
Forms. I think we all like forms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know. But then if we associate something negative with them, then we don't like them because we are associating something negative with them. But we like other
forms, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that's what's going on. So, you know, I think there's a lot of negativity around experiences people have had with different religious forms, not because of just the ego of the people that they were dealing with. And they're not recognizing that what they didn't really like wasn't the forms.
Right.
It was the power trips or the hypocrisies or da-da-da-da, all those things.
Well, a lot of people, I mean, that come, they say, well, not a lot of people, but some people say that the rituals don't speak to them. You know, that the rituals that we do there don't speak to them. That.
And I would respond to that. Personally, I would respond to that. Then you need to do them more. Because then they'll become embedded and they will be something you will expect.
But these are, like, I can think of one person in particular who really did give it a good shot, you know, coming pretty regularly participating in everything, and she didn't experience it as a child. And I wonder if that makes it a lot more difficult, I think, for people, because it takes longer, or it takes more getting past the resistance in their head or something. I don't know. I mean, I don't know, but I have come to the conclusion, and I don't mind offering things at Great Tree that are, you know, that are more appealing and more interesting, you know, like the writing retreat. My gosh, you know, we've got a waiting list. But I feel like what I've experienced and what I have to offer, you know, that takes enough of my effort and energy to stay with that and to go in a whole nother direction and figure out something that's going to be more interesting or more appealing. It's just...
Well, haven't you already decided there's certain things about the Japanese culture of it that you're not bringing over, so to speak?
And there's certain things that are not part of Japanese... the Japanese Zen that I am like you have included, like, you know, yoga and Alexander technique, and
so you are flexible.
Yeah, I'm flexible, but evidently, you know, not making it interesting enough. Or something. I'm willing.
You can't please everybody.
Yeah.
I think that's just something that you really want to your bodhicitta, you just really want to help everyone, and so that when someone doesn't feel like they're being helped, it's disappointing. And, you know, you try and think of some way to do that, but you have to let some go.
Mm-hmm. Rock and roll retreats. I mean, that's just not, you know.
Well, one thing I would add is in hearing this, I'm glad to hear, and that dissonance between American culture as it is, and Zen practice, authentic Zen practice, what happens at a Sishin. When you were talking, and I've been at Zen centers, and I've been at Sishins and other places where it feels mechanical. It just feels mechanical. And everyone can be a little robotic. But I never felt that a Great Tree, you know. And when you were talking, even just to start with the poem, I was thinking about one Sesshin season, I think, a winter season, where we had snow and ice off and on. Maybe it was two seasons, I don't know. But, you know, I don't even think about I didn't necessarily think about when you were talking, you know, not consciously, but I didn't think about the Zendo or that. But I did think about, I did have mental images of being with people and sweeping snow off the deck and walking down the driveway with people with putting salt on the driveway and coming in for breakfast. And someone lighting the fire, and sitting and having breakfast by the fire, what you were saying, being the longing for the ancient ways, that kind of radical simplicity, and I think what happens in a Sishin is that it's not like a workshop, and it's not American feelings and niceties or whatever. But it is kind of a radical peace that kind of can develop, a surprising, deep, simple, basic peace that can develop. And it takes an awful lot. It takes a radical sense to try to make an effort to recreate that and live that out within the American cultural context that we have here, which is so commerce-driven and image-driven and driven by things that are complicated and electronic and mechanical and forced and not authentic. So I think to experience that radical, authentic simplicity in this Isshin presents presents a great challenge when you're not there. You know, and I think that's maybe that's a big issue for people. Mm-hmm. They say, well, let's make this more like what I know in everyday life. Let's make it not so authentic and beautiful and good, because I can never reproduce it outside, but we have to. Mm-hmm. And we have to see what it is first, so we can make an effort.
I think it's true that people are not seeing the connection, and that's part of the difficulty. And I don't know, I mean, there's no way you can do that except by throwing yourself into it.
And throwing yourself in it and having to deal with the fact of being radically surprised or upended by what simplicity feels like.
If
you're not in a cultural context where you've been able to understand it before.
And maybe there's that feeling of disconnect. Yeah. I was just thinking as you were talking about how I was raised in Minneapolis, you know, and I didn't have too much going out to the country experience. I had an uncle that had a farm, and we'd go out there once in a while for a family gathering or something for a couple hours. But when I got in my 20s and I started going out to my friend's farm and staying there overnight, I remember always the first night I would just completely collapse and into tears, and just that transition from the city to the country, to just the simplicity,
the stillness
of it. Yeah. And it was just, it is big, and I hadn't really thought about it in that way before. But
my first night of Sishin is always, oh, thank God. Oh, thank God.
Right.
I'm never leaving.
I know. I mean, I'm that way every single, oh, good, Sishin's coming. You know? Every month when Sishin comes around, oh, good, this Friday. And we're into such a routine now that we don't even shopping is not a big issue. We've got our menu and our staples. And yeah. Thank you all.